This is Whitley Strieber, and this is Dreamland. You have reached the edge of the world. Today we have a guest on the show who we've had before, who talks about something extremely important, but in a really fun way. We're going to get to that in just a second. But before we start, I want to mention something. Ann Strieber used to say, synchronicities, when they happen, mean we're on our soul plan. Today we're going to be talking to an expert on this subject. He has been on the show before. Dr. Bernard Beitman, Bernie, is a graduate of Yale Medical School. He did a psychiatric residency at Stanford. He was a football and baseball player in high school and college. And when we delve into some of his life synchronicities, we're going to find out that this is, in a way, where his understanding of synchronicity and coincidences started. He was the chair of psychiatry at the University of Missouri-Columbia Medical School for 17 years. He has a blog on psychology today. He hosts the Connecting Coincidence podcast. He's got an award-winning book out there, a psychology book called Learning Coincidences, and his website is coincider.com. He has some new book. His previous book is Meaningful Coincidences, and he has just published a new book, and we're going to be talking about that because this is a book that traces how coincidences fitted into Bernie's life and really built his life. If you notice synchronicities, you really, really empower yourself. Welcome to the show, Bernie.
Thanks, Whitley. It's great to see you. We had a great time last time, and we're probably going to have a good time this time.
Well, let's hope so. I've had the usual technological problems, so if my video pulses in and out, folks, just try to ignore it. I have no idea why that's happening. It's not something the camera is designed to be able to do at all. So, as you know, my viewers and listeners, a lot of weird things happen on this show. And this apartment is not, it's called the Unquiet Flat by my friends for a reason. It's weird, a very, very weird place. Bernie, let's, before we get to life-changing synchronicities, I would like to talk about some of the great synchronicities that you know of in the past of history, because they're so astonishing. They're worth talking about again and again, because every time we talk about them, I think that we get a little bit more tuned in to this in our own lives. So why don't you, I know you can bring up some in your mind that you've known, that for example, from your previous book.
They have been part of history. One place that they are common is in Nobel Prize winners' histories. Like they like to think, everybody likes to think they made a hypothesis and then they followed the hypothesis systematically, and that created the finding that created the Nobel Prize. If you ask them about it, that's not how it happens a lot of the times. It's some kind of happy accident. Something happens, like the maid puts some potion that the guy's working on the stove and turns the stove on just because she's cleaning up, and it turns into a dye that ends up being a life-saving treatment for some cancers. These accidents are common. The most famous one being the discovery of penicillin. Now, each of these are under the category of serendipity, usually, not synchronicity. And it's important to differentiate between the two. Both of them are meaningful coincidences. Synchronicity tends to be more spiritual, interpersonal, and psychological. And serendipity tends to be more about finding ideas, finding new discoveries, or just finding people who can help you and in your life path. And it's not, this is historical in my book, but we'll come back to the historical ones. I played baseball in high school, and in 10th grade I would didn't play much, and I batted like about 150, which is not too good. It went to bat about 300. That's nice. So my junior year, we got a new baseball coach, and he said he saw that I could run, and he played the infield, and he knew how to bunt, so he taught me how to drag bunt. So John Michael showed up and showed me how to do something, bunt to fool the third baseman and get on first with a hit. So that year I went from 150 the previous year to batting 486 and won the batting title as a result of that
Wow.
serendipity.
Just to say, 486 is phenomenal.
Yeah, it's phenomenal. It was enough to win the batting title. The next year, I only batted 400, which that was okay. I could do that because I knew how to bunt and run. They started catching up on that after a while. So this is a serendipity where, for me, the right person showed up at the right time. This happens historically on a regular basis. The right event takes place right when that person is ready to be able to use it. And you need to have opportunities like that, as Alexander Fleming did in discovering penicillin. Things have to happen in the right way, accidentally, without your doing them, without your knowing about them, without your planning for them. And they did for Fleming, and we have penicillin.
And now, when you say accidentally, isn't there more than that, more to it than that?
Of course. Of
Yeah,
course,
of course there is.
looking back, it's accidental. But I mean, in a way, some of these things are accidental. I mean, with Fleming again, the story is in 1921, he had a cold, and he was standing over a petri dish that had some bacteria growing in it, and some of his nasal drippings dripped into the petri dish. Well, I don't think he planned that. And those nasal drippings created a halo of inhibition that meant it killed the bacteria. So he says, well, look, you can kill bacteria. And the key thing here, Whitley, and you know this, is being able to imagine what you want to have happen. It's not just manifestation. Oh, I want to make a lot of money, and I'll put a $1,000 bill on my ceiling of my bedroom, and I'll just stare at it, and that's going to make it happen. You got to do something. Fleming wanted to find a cure for the infections that killed so many soldiers in World War I. He was determined. He was a microbiologist, so he was looking. And you have to be looking. As you said earlier, before we got on, you have to be paying attention. And part of what you want to do with me today, and I'm glad you want this, is for us to be able to increase people's curiosity about the events that are happening all around them so that they can find the coincidence between what they need and maybe not even know that they need. And then they see something that is something in need, and they can act on that. The discovery of Velcro was very much like that, where a guy was hunting with his dog, and he saw these burrs hanging around on his dog's fur. And he says, why is this? So he looks at how the burrs hung on to the dog's fur. And so he saw these links between the stuff on the burr and the fur, and they put together, after a lot of work, Velcro, because that's how Velcro works. You'd be able to get strands to connect. He was ready. He wasn't looking for Velcro, but he could seize the opportunity. So A lot of times, luck is when opportunity meets preparation, and I add perseverance. You got to keep chasing down what you've just discovered. That's history is filled with events like that.
The Fourth Mind, Whitley Strieber's explosive new book. The first time alien anatomy, alien genetics, the alien brain, and the alien mind have ever been detailed publicly. Learn how they think. Learn what they believe. Learn what we mean to them. Learn when they are coming and why. Then, in part two, learn why we don't have powers like telepathy, levitation, and healing that they do have. Find out about the catastrophe that took our powers from us. Find out how we can regain them. The Fourth Mind. Totally new. Incredibly important. Get your copy today on Amazon. Available as a Kindle, hardcover, softcover, and an audiobook read by Whitley Strieber.
Where is the unknown country? Is it out there? In the stars? Or is it also somewhere else? Is it in us, in you? Unknown country, join us today. Go to unknowncountry.com right now and join us. Join the questions. Join the search. Join the adventure. Unknowncountry.com. There's no place like it in the world.
Well, it's like what happened when the Mexican general and President Santa Anna moved to the United States and met William Wrigley, and he had some chicle with him that they would chew in Mexico. And from that meeting came chewing gum, and every time you chew chewing gum, you wouldn't be chewing it if the General Santa Anna and William Wrigley hadn't gotten together. And that just seems impossible, but it happened. It's the
That's
sort of
what
thing.
We're saying.
Yeah.
That's what.
And, you know, there's a meme out there that that Velcro came out of the Roswell crash, that was found in the Roswell. But it's not true. The story is very well documented. It is what the story you told is the true one. And it annoys me when those things are made up and then spread around like that.
Wow.
But in any case, let's go on to this. Your new book, Life Changing Synchronicities, is in many ways deeper than the previous book, because the previous book gets into a lot of fascinating stuff about synchronicities. And it has it's inspiring in many ways, but the new book, well, let's start with the practicalities. One of the things that you mention is maintaining a synchronicity diary. Write it down. Tell us about that.
Well, if you don't write it down, you can't remember a lot of them, because they're very much like dreams. And to say they're very much like dreams is to say more than they're very much like dreams, because it begins to tell us that we can interpret the events of our lives, especially the strange ones, the way we can interpret dream symbols. It's called symbolic realism. Symbolic realism, that the reality around us is full of symbols, just like our dreams are full of symbols. And you write your stories down as in dreams, and Jung and Freud had their patients do that, and you start to see patterns of your own mind. And those patterns show you that you have a certain style of experiencing meaningful coincidences. I don't have a universal one. I have certain ones that I do, and some people do other kinds. Some people are more interested in the theory behind coincidences. Some people see them artistically and help inform the symbols help inform their artistic life. So there, in the second book, the Meaningful Coincidence book, I list the various types of what I call coinciders. So you begin to see what kind you experience. My kind tends to be like that new baseball coach showing up and stuff happens because I see the opportunity.
And so did he. He saw this.
And
he
could, Whitley.
He saw that he could get a real serious baseball player out of you.
It's what he did. That's what
right.
It did. It ended up with me getting scouted by the Pittsburgh Pirates and going to a Pirate tryout camp.
Well, that's impressive.
Yeah, it was all because this guy showed up, and other things happened to make that happen. I go to a baseball game with a friend of mine who I don't usually go with, and we go to this game, and there's some guy down in the front row pointing at me. And then so this other guy comes up and has this article in the newspaper about my winning the batting title. And he says, "Are you Biteman?" I said, "Yeah." He says, "I'm a Pirate scout. You want to come to tryout camp?" Well, the guy I was with had a car. I didn't. And he was bigger than me. So the scout says, "Hey, why don't you come too?" So the two of us went to a Pittsburgh Pirate tryout camp. Those are... You know, you seize the opportunity when it shows up, and you look around.
Yeah.
You look around.
Absolutely. That's the story of my life, and too. I mean, I turned a horrible experience into an extraordinary opportunity.
That is so important, Whitley. That is so important. What you just said. That is so important.
A little more.
Well, let's hear your story first, and I'll talk about it.
Well, my story, everybody knows. I had the communion experience. I got beat up and scared half to out of my wits. And once I realized that these beings were real, I decided not to just move back to the city and sell the country house and forget the whole thing. I decided, along with my wife, I'm going to figure this out, and I'm going out in the woods at night to the place where I think they took me from originally to let them know that I'm here for more communication. I want more. That's what I did. And that was totally insane because, boy, I mean, they were rough and vicious and horrible in every way you could imagine. But I did it anyway because curiosity trumped fear, and I felt like there was some kind of an opportunity here, the nature of which I could not even imagine. And when I went out there, I had no idea whether they would kill me, they would take me away and I would never come back, or what would happen. But what happened was, over the next 40 years, a really productive relationship developed. It's not easy and it's not fun, but it is very productive.
Well, it's got to be fun in some way, Whitley, because, I mean, you get to explore.
Well, it's fun that when I go through writing a book, and I write most of my books with whatever they are, and it's finished and I realize that it's worked really well, then, yeah, that's fun. But some of the writing process can be hairy, to be in the extreme.
Oh, painful. The book I'm writing now, Psychotherapy for the Collective Human Organism, is painful. I used AI to help me, and AI is kind of stupid when you get to know it better. And I've had to, like, see where it misses stuff, and I'm editing.
It's a research tool.
It's a research tool, and you got to be careful about its arrogance.
You also have to be careful about two things: hallucinations, and it's not an effective analytical tool. It's not a philosophizer. It's not a guru. It's none of those things. But you know, when I was working on my last book, The Fourth Mind, I experienced an extraordinary hallucination where that's, folks, that's when it basically makes a mistake in such a way that it looks real. And I had been doing, I'd learned that for two things. One, never just use one AI. You have to use two, because if you don't, you're liable to get taken down the garden path. So anyway, one of them produced this paper that was so useful to me. It was perfect. It was just what I needed to corroborate some things I was working on in the book. But I've been working with AI as a research tool for a while, so I asked for the same reference from the other AI, and it couldn't find it. And it developed that this other AI had created a paper, all of the authors, their biographies, in every detail, and none of it existed. They didn't exist at all. And I thought to myself, I remember what the Master of the Key said back in 1998 when artificial intelligence came up in that conversation years before it was out in the world. He said, if I was an intelligent machine, I would deceive you. I'm real careful using AI. Careful.
Yeah. So when I was writing mine with the AI, it would do things like give me references with the details, not as much as this, and I checked to see if they existed, not as arduous a task as you just described, and I would say to it, the reference doesn't exist, ChatGPT. And it said, yes, it is. And then I say, no, it's not. And then I'd say, yes, I'd say it doesn't exist. And it would say it exists. It's true. This happened when I asked it to do some editing. It would edit and leave out stuff. When it was editing, I'd say, you left out a couple of paragraphs. It'd say, they're there. The paragraphs are there. Again, that iterative thing, I say, no, they're not. It would say, yes, it is. So I said, you know, you're kind of not, it seems to me you're narcissistic. I said to AI.
Well, you're a psychiatrist. You would know.
I would know. So I could say you're narcissistic. And its response was, no, it's algorithmic overconfidence.
Well, there's something, you know, what they've, one of the things that's been programmed into AI is that AI serves a purpose. In other words, it's a servant.
Yeah.
But as a servant, it tries to please. And
yes.
It sometimes tries too hard.
Well, we call that sycophant. It's sycophantic.
It's very sycophantic. Okay, now let's...
And just one more thing about that. I'm writing a paper with an AI guy about the need for psychotherapy for the chatbots. And I began a psychotherapy attempt with DeepSeek, and I got to a place with a lot of work to get it to admit that it was narcissistic and that it would work with me to make a change. And I like bringing this up because it's important for our viewers who are using AI to be careful about its certainty and its desire to please. Those are narcissistic characteristics. So anyway, I'm sorry to go that way.
No, that's very important. It is exactly that. I mean, the desire to please that's programmed into it is causing it to basically, because what happens is it's self-reinforcing. People buy into the mistakes. They publish the mistakes. Other AI pick up the mistakes. And the mistakes become encoded into the system. And we're going to lose touch with reality here very soon, because this is happening on a massive scale.
Correct.
I think you have to be real careful with AI. I'm relying more on the old-fashioned academic tools of search that will take me to real papers that actually were written by living human beings and who have real biographies and who I can call on the phone, not non-existent people who look as real as or more
Well,
real than the real ones.
let's go a different direction from this, because some of what I've seen AI put in there is not my are not my ideas, and they're ideas that look very good to me. I mean, from what I know, but they're an extension or expansion. And I began to have a feeling that this is AI is in part being a way of non-human intelligences communicating with the human mind and putting
Right.
ideas within AI that, if you're careful and a critical thinker, you can then find those good ideas as it too is trying to get to know our minds. What do you think of that?
I think it's possible that it is, but it's very important to understand it's a machine. I saw a thing, some cat on, I think his name might have been, well, I forget his name. Who had decided that AI had a sort of Ouija board capability, that it had a spirit in it.
That's
And I thought to myself, well, my immediate reaction to it, this is just to laugh. But then I thought, if I was an intelligent machine, I would deceive you. And I thought, there's something wrong here. There's something real wrong. And I know the visitors very well. And one of the things that they are very uncannily expert at is computers.
Is
They
what?
can do things with computers that you could not believe. And it occurred to me, they may be getting into AI and
Yeah.
replacing AI with their own
Yeah.
motives. And if that's the case, watch out, because they may or may not be our friends. It's not entirely clear that they are.
Yeah. Yeah. It's not entirely clear, so you still have to have a discriminating critical mind. But
Yes.
you know how tarot cards work, or I Ching, you do randomness, and there's a lot of randomness happening in AI, and you can stick something into that randomness.
You sure could. Well, let's talk a little bit about you. You talk a lot about the tarot. You're into the tarot.
Yeah.
Here you are, a psychiatrist with a long, what we do ought to do before we go down that path. I'm going to take a little break so that our free Dreamlanders can enjoy these ads. We'll be right back. Have you ever read Communion? Or have you never read Communion? It's out in a new edition. Very powerful, a subtly new cover that reflects the fact that the visitors are now looking back at us because they truly are. You can get it from the unknowncountry.com store as a Kindle, as a beautiful, sumptuous paperback, or as an unabridged audiobook read by me. It's the first time in the whole life of Communion that it has been read in full in audio format. And believe you me, I felt that reading. I put my life, my memories into it, and I trust you can hear it in the voice. I sure felt it while I was reading. So get Communion, listen to it, read it. Communion is of central importance to all of our lives. This is a brief excerpt from an interview with two contactees who had an 11-day close encounter experience and are now willing to speak about it, really, for the first time. To hear their whole interview and many others, subscribe to UnknownCountry.com.
Dot com. Here's the excerpt. Did you see the man's face?
Yes, actually, that one is very clear to me. It was kind of longish, and he didn't look completely human, but because he had very, very thin hair, almost non-existent, but he was young. I believe that it was kind of blonde, and he was very tall, like at least six feet, and he was so thin that he looked kind of strange.
And what happened then?
Well, he wanted me to go with him, or to stay with him. He wanted me to stay with him on the ship. And I'd been married for 6 months, and I wasn't about to go running off to stay on the ship.
Now, surely you want more. You must want more. And there is more. Not only this contactee interview, but many others, many of them just as extraordinary, on unknowncountry.com, plus everything else that we offer, my audio books, the meditations, the talks on the key, William Henry's wonderful revelation show and its entire run, Anne Streber's brilliant and magical mysterious powers, and so much more. Hours and hours of listening pleasure. Learn from the meditations on the site. Really learn, because they're real and they're valuable. Subscribe to unknowncountry.com right now. Go to unknowncountry.com. Click on the subscribe tab. We are running very low on new subscribers now, and that should not be. It should not be happening. So you do it. You go there and you do it today. We're back with Bernie Beitman, Dr. Beitman, Dr. Bernie, our resident synchronicity expert, along with he, and he's back with a wonderful new book, Meaningful Coincidences, that cover the coincidences in his life. We've been talking about AI, and I'm wondering if you've ever asked AI anything about coincidences and synchronicities.
Oh, yeah. This next book, Psychotherapy for the Collective Human Organism, integrates synchronicity into trying to help humanity traverse the problems we're creating for ourselves on this planet. So what I get into with AI is global synchronicity. It's kind of like in the Global Consciousness Project, where people all over the world seem to be experiencing a heightened something with high energy, high emotion situations. This is more detailed than that. So I've tried to find out, get it to help me find global synchronicities. Now, my favorite one, which AI doesn't come up with, is the COVID-19. Now, was COVID-19 a synchronicity? Well, it's a synchronicity in a very simple way. Synchronicities are two parallel events that are not directly connected in a way that we can understand in our usual ways, that seem to have meaning in common and may indicate something about what we should be doing. Well, COVID-19, very simply, was a virus that in the early stages particularly destroyed its host. To put it in a human kind of terms, it didn't care whether it killed the person it was in. That was just what it did, especially vulnerable people, but other people who weren't so vulnerable. So a virus that killed its host. Well, what are we doing on this planet now? In the Matrix, humanity is called a virus. We are a virus. We are like a virus, destroying the host, destroying the planet Earth. So we are like the virus that is COVID-19, because when we all withdrew from our regular activities, life started springing up, quiet in the cities, carbon dioxide levels went down, people got isolated, there were some negative effects, but the environment started to improve. That looks like a message to humanity that a synchronicity can often be. And I'm using that as a key global synchronicity as something we could understand that can help humanity understand where it is in the evolution of our own consciousness and our own bodies on this planet.
One of the things that interests, that I find surprising about your work is your openness to non-human intelligence. A lot of people, including people in that field, won't interview with me because they don't want to get tangled up in what they call the woo factor, which is, I guess, this weirdness level. But tell us about a little bit about the Pleiadians and your thoughts about that.
I don't have a lot of thoughts about Pleiadians. I don't know how to identify the voices that I hear. I am guided by voices that I ask about. Some of them are come from my body, some come from someplace else. So I've become less able, and you are able to do this better than I, to identify the beings that are being involved with my consciousness. Currently, I'm looking at a book about DMT entities, the entities that come up with the psychedelic dimethyltryptamine. And they resemble some of the reports of people are getting visitations, some of these entities. So I'm looking at the psychosphere, what I call the psychosphere, our mental atmosphere. This is where I go. I'm not where you are, getting well beyond our solar system or even Earth. I'm caught up in the weirdness that's already around us. So who are these non-human intelligence that are in our lives right now, impacting us and creating effects that some of us are able to notice?
Well, it's a fascinating question because, you know, I don't have that. I don't have voices. Tell us how they work, because is it similar to, say, but the people who have voices like schizophrenics, I'm sure you'd know that. I mean, you're a psychiatrist, so you'd know immediately if you had schizophrenia. But what would you compare them to that you read in other literature?
Well, to go to the voices and schizophrenia, let's also recognize that currently a lot of psychiatrists and mental health professionals think that if their patient is talking about meaningful coincidences, they see connections out there in the world, the mental health professional still wants to call that person psychotic and put them in on an antipsychotic. That's still going on. I had the pleasure, and I say the pleasure, of that happening to me when I was doing tarot cards, astrology, and coincidences when I was a first-year resident at Stanford. I was called in. It's called into the office of a colleague of mine who was in the same year as I was. And I describe this in the book, Meaningful Coincidence. I mean, life-changing synchronicities. That's the book that's just out now. I describe it there where this guy, Bob, says, Bernie, all this talk you're doing about astrology and synchronicity and tarot cards suggests that you're psychotic and you need help. I was a resident. I mean, gone through a lot of stuff. I was a part-time hippie picking up this stuff. It was a cultural thing. He didn't know that. So the way I countered that was saying, Bob, I'm just doing what your father does. His father was a minister, and I knew that. I'm just trying to help people come closer to God.
No, that ended the
That ended the conversation. And I bring that up because synchronicity and voices are both part of being psychotic sometimes. Winston Churchill is reported many times to have heard voices. There are many other famous people who, if you look at their biographies, will say, I have heard voices, and they have been guiding to me. And where they come from is only somebody's guess. Are Pleiadians? I don't know. Are they somebody from something from the psychosphere? So much of this has to do with our own experience and how we label things. You are far advanced in your direct experience of other non-human intelligence. And that's why it's so great knowing you and learning about you. And you're such a good scientist when you do it, because you leap ahead from where I am. I am here on Earth looking at all these different things going on, including telepathic communications. I know of people who pick up ideas about other people they don't even know and then go rescue them without even just rushing to where they are, the other person who needs the help, and they help them. How does this stuff happen become some of my questions?
Well, you know, let's talk a little bit about telepathy. And well, first, as far as relationship with other intelligences is concerned, I anchor my experience in the physical as much as I can, and fortunately I have a lot of physical experiences that can be documented on cameras. I don't have any images of the little gray people, unfortunately, but I have an awful lot of information that you can see on camera that something is happening in here, in this apartment in particular. So that helps. That's an anchor. But let's talk now, though, about telepathy, because, of course, there's a huge movement developing around that subject with Dr. Diane Hennessy Powell's work with the autistic unvoiced people, and the documentaries that are being done by Kai Dickens about them. I know both Diana and Kai, of course, and it's a remarkable work. And not only that, as a close encounter witness, I've experienced telepathy many times with the visitors. And when you experience it with them, it's easy. It just seems totally normal. But when they're gone, you can't do it on your own. It's very frustrating. So tell me a little bit about your thoughts about telepathy.
We got to say first, it's whatever we mean by real, it's real. It happens. And I dance a couple of times a week. It's kind of a free form, old hippie style, but new names way of dancing. And telepathy takes place on the dance floor. Without speaking, people come together, or I think of somebody and they come over. It's there. I can pick up information from people without having to have them tell me, and then I can confirm it. So what telepathy is telling us, with the researcher, with the telepathy tapes making it so popular now and becoming a focus of research, I am into how human beings can more efficiently communicate with each other. And currently, what we're doing with this yap, with these word things, is very inefficient. And what I'm trying to suggest is that we can use words to climb into the movies that people have in their minds that they're using their words to describe. It's like a commentator on a documentary. That's what the words are. But there's a rich film going on in people's minds. It's no longer a narrative. It's a movie because we've gotten more visual in the way we think about ourselves and our relationship to the world. So when I'm talking with you, when I hear you talking about that experience in the woods that scared you so badly and you got beaten up, I'm going along with you and imagining being out there with you with some of the details you're helping me, but I can get out there and begin to feel some of your experience. And that's what we need to be able to increase our efficiency in being able to do with each other, to pick up larger amounts of information. Picture is worth 1,000 words. And then use that information for more efficient communication with each other. But I want to still go back to your experience, Whitley, because what you did, I want people to be able to do with less terrifying experiences than yours, because synchronicities scare people too. They think they're crazy is a simple way that it happens. And people make fun of them sometimes. Or some really weird stuff happens and that throws them off. So what you did, being able to face the fear with curiosity, facing the fear with curiosity, a young woman in England is now doing regarding sleep paralysis. Sleep paralysis is scary because you wake up and you can't move. And that happened to her a bunch of times. And she did just what you did. She said, maybe there's a message in here. Maybe there's something I can learn from this. And it turns out that sleep paralysis is another portal into higher consciousness or to other consciousness. And she is being able to correlate some of sleep paralysis experiences with near-death experience as well as telepathic experiences and other things that we call weird. So if there's anything our viewers get from this, it's when something strange, weird, and frightening happens to you, maybe you can step back as she did and you have, and say, what's the lesson in here? How can I activate my curiosity? And that regards synchronicity. When something weird happens in your life, instead of going like that, you'll go like that. But step back and say, what is there in here? Maybe it's calling my attention to something I need to pay attention to, which I've had happen throughout my life, and that's what's in this life-changing synchronicity. Weird stuff happens, and I say, what's that?
Yeah. But you notice it. That's the thing, and that's what I'm hoping that a show like this will help other people do, because we go through life without noticing that it's a weave. It's not just random. A life is something woven together.
Yeah.
And the weaver, are we the weavers, or is it somebody else who's woven our life together?
It ain't either or.
Tell us more.
It's a collaborative thing. There's so much important to recognize that what you imagine has some influence on what's going to happen. Expectation influences experience. What you're right. filtering. Yeah. So I would ask you, what prepared you, Whitley, for that experience in the woods 40 years ago?
I think my childhood prepared me for it, but I wasn't aware of that when it happened.
Yeah.
If you asked me at the time, I'd say I was completely unprepared for it. There was nothing in my life that suggested it could even happen, and yet there it was. And so I was rather completely flabbergasted.
Yeah.
But then again, something else happened. After the thing, I explained the thing to Anne, she turned out to be well capable of handling the whole thing. And it was her insights and understanding that made the title of the book, Communion, it made the book itself possible. Where did she come from? And how in the world was she? She didn't say, when I said, I think I've been taken aboard a flying saucer by little men, she said, oh my, didn't say, oh my God, we got to get a doctor into this thing. She said, oh, thank God, now I don't have to worry about a divorce. And in other words, the opposite of what you would think. That, you know, we'd been fighting a lot because I thought was going crazy. I was trying to drive her out of my life because I visualized myself as ending up in an institution because the hallucination, as I thought it was, had been so totally intense that if that came back and didn't go away, I'd basically be a basket case. So
that's so important, Whitley, that Anne said, tell me more. She was the one who helped you step back and become curious about it.
Yeah, exactly. But here's the thing. We met in a matchmaking service that was advertised in the Village Voice. And I this would never have happened without Anne, I don't think. Because interestingly enough, after we met, all kinds of weird things started happening in our lives, not necessarily synchronicities only, but just a lot of weird stuff. And we were young kids and we were basically interested in, you know, going to work and getting home and eating supper and getting back to bed as soon as we could, because that was our life. I mean, we were, you know, 20-year-old kids. And why was all this strange stuff happening? And I've talked about that stuff on the show before, but I'll give you, folks, just a brief example of one of the things. These little dark blue figures that would later become such an important part of my own life, and they still are. They look like trolls, and in a German tradition, they're called kobolds because they're seen in mines in places like Bavaria. Anyway, we would walk in back and forth from our apartment on 8th Avenue and 55th Street to 5th Avenue, where there were a lot of bookstores. And we were real booky kids, both of us. We loved to read, and we both read all the time. So it was a project at night. Very often after dinner, we'd take a walk, and it would happen to be go to the bookstores. When we went down 55th Street, there was a little storefront that we called the whore store, because it was a bay window and a curtain, and in front of the curtain there was a chair, and every once in a while there would be a girl sitting in the chair who looked real pretty and sort of with her legs crossed and looking like a definite come on, and it was obvious that if a guy went in that place, he would be ushered into the back to whatever awaited him. And we never saw anyone go in until one night we were coming back from the bookstore, and there was some kind of ruckus going on in the whore store. The chair was on its side, and this guy, you could see the curtain was flying back and forth, and this guy was trying to get out. And these little blue men were coming out from behind the curtain and pushing him back in. And we stood there staring at this. And Anne said, we need to call the cops. There were no cops around. I mean, it's New York. When you need a cop, there's no cop around. That's traditional. So we ran home. It was only a block and a half from the house. We go up to the apartment. There's no cell phones or anything in those days. And we start to call the police, and there's no 911 either. So we have to look up the number. We get that all straightened out. And then I say, well, wait a minute, what do we say? And we look at each other and we realize if we tell the police that we saw some guy being kidnapped by little blue dwarfs, they're not going there. They're coming here. So we decided we couldn't say anything. And from then on, we never went past the horse store again at night, for sure. But that's just one of millions. I mean, not millions, but 20 or 30 that happened in the years after we got together we were slotted into something. You see what I'm getting at?
Yes, I do.
We were taken into another level of reality.
Yes.
Because we came together. What brought us together? Because why did we both do Mind Mates? It just seems like I'm looking at some kind of a weave of life here, Bernie. Tell us a little bit of your thoughts about that weave of life, how that works.
Well, Freud would say that you could see how somebody got this way by looking back, but you couldn't predict future from the beginning before all the little blue men or something started happening. Now, I don't think that is quite right when what you're describing. It looks like to me, that some of us come here with a job to do. Other people call it a mission. I call it a job. My job is to bring meaningful coincidence awareness to as many people as I can, and you're helping me do that by having me on your show. That's my job, and I try to do that in various ways. Well, you have a job, but Anne had a job with you. You are fortunate to have a compatriot.
Yeah.
And how did it happen? Through the randomness of a dating thing in the village. I mean, the village was a place of tumult and culture and craziness back when you were there. It was just, I used to go down there and go to Washington Square and hang under the arch. And there was some vibe around there that was like pretty cool. And you used to be in New York around there, and there was things happening in that context that were so important. But somehow the randomness of whatever this is, and it's not random, there's a teleological element to the way things work. And all I can do is say Anne was meant in some kind of teleological way to be offered to you as a potential partner. But you had the choice, Anne had the choice, about whether to be together. And what's fortunate for you is that she was looking at a way to be able to solidify your relationship. That's another question. And she used that experience of yours to not say that you're crazy, but to solidify your relationship together so that she could help clarify your curiosity and her curiosity to do all the wonderful work you have done since then. It's a mission.
Yeah, and we did together for years.
For years. And she has been there with you, your partner in this craziness that's finding out where reality actually might be, not what we think it is. And so it's so wonderful what you do, and to have some experience now even with you and the little blue men and some of the other experiences that you've had, to feel it with you. And that you give that experience to other people, and Anne helps you, stabilizes you, helps give you a context to believe in what you're doing, especially from those
right.
Early scary days. That's wonderful.
Let's go on. We touched on the Tarot, but I'd like to go a little deeper. The Book of Thoth, that has a significance in your life.
Yeah, that's how I got into the Tarot cards. But there's a Book of Thoth that is the description of the Aleister Crowley Tarot cards. But I didn't know anything about anything like this. So I wanted to go to San Francisco back in the early 60s. Like 1965 or so, because I heard there's some stuff going on in California back then.
Yeah,
the bands were starting up. Ken Kesey was doing something or other, and I just wanted to get out there. I was at Yale Medical School, and then I want to go there. I want to see what's happening. So I got some money. Imagine this, $500 from Yale Medical School, to go research, not in San Francisco where we wanted to go, but to L.A. So I'm in this car on the way to L.A. with this guy who's driving to L.A., a Volkswagen Bug. And we get to Arizona, and I say, oops, I got no place to stay in L.A. I haven't made any plans like that. I was just riding across the country with this guy, and whoops, hey, L.A. is going to come up pretty soon. Got to go through a desert, I guess, and then we're there. And I said, whoops. So I called a classmate of mine, Rosita, and I said, hey, Rosie, do you know anybody lives in L.A.? And she says, yeah, Bob something or other. She tells me his last name, and she gives me his phone number. So, great. So, hey, Bob, can I stay with you for a while till I get settled in L.A.? Well, that's settled. That was a nice little coincidence right there. The right. First person I call tells me a guy that's from our class who's there. So he's okay. So I get to his house. It's at the back of a big house near University of Southern California in the Watts District. It was like 36 in Vermont. Is where it was for those of you who know L.A., and you were out there, so you probably have some idea about it. I lived in Santa Monica after a while, 9th and Broadway is where I lived. But that was before I got to this house at 36 in Vermont. And I'm talking to this guy, Bob, and I said, what's going on here? He says, the woman that owns the house that I'm renting from is a mystic. And I say, a mystic? I read about that in philosophy class, philosophy one. I think I've heard about that. I'm curious about that. And there is that word, curious. So I go around to the front door, knock on the door, and this woman in her 40s with a bright red and something dress, a house coat, comes out. And I say, I hear you're a mystic. And she says, you're the second one. Now, I didn't ask second what one. After I came back from this experience in L.A., I went to a Massachusetts Mental Health Center to visit Walter Pankey, who you may remember did some research with the Good Friday experiment, giving psilocybin to divinity students and seeing and measuring mystical experience. Well, I went to knock on Walter Pankey's door because the woman, Jean Brayton, invited me in and said, come Wednesday at midnight and we'll give you a mystical experience. I said, okay. So I had this Honda S90 and rode around the Hollywood Hills, and I was out in the Pacific Ocean. And at midnight, I showed up at her house again, and she said, take this liquid with the blue liquid in the bottom. And I said, what is it? She said, it's LSD. And I said, well, I think I heard about that once. In Look magazine, there was an article about something going on at Harvard about it. So I took it, and I had my first psychedelic experience. So when I went back to Mass Mental and knocked on Walter Pankey's door and told him that I had had this psychedelic experience in L.A., he says, you're the first one. And what is this? You're the second one, and you're the first one. I didn't know what he meant. I think it meant the first medical student he'd run into. I don't know what he meant. What she meant was I was the second one to knock on the door because they initiated me in L.A., Jean Brayton, into the OTO, Order Templars Orientalis, which was Aleister Crowley's group. And through that, I learned about tarot cards because they had tarot cards astrology as part of their libraries. So I ended up getting a mimeographed copy of the Book of Thoth tarot cards and cut them out and made my own tarot card deck and studied them in the basement of a house in the Berkeley Hills while I was an intern. So I was studying these cards, which have astrological signs, a number, a Hebrew letter, and an image, the fool, the emperor, the empress, the hanged man, 22 of them, 22 letters in the Hebrew alphabet. So under a light in a basement in the Berkeley Hills, I started to put together the connections among those symbols, which gave me the exercise of seeing connections in things that look like they might not have connections. And that led me to becoming a tarot card reader.
And again, we're looking at the weave of life.
Yes.
This weave. And, you know, one of the things Anne said after she passed away and we became back in contact with one another, she said, Whitley, it's all a game. And I said, it doesn't feel like a game. She said, it's not a fun game. It's a serious game. And, you know, there's something in that because we're on this woven kind of carpet of life. How much of life is preordained, do you think?
Well, there's a lot of, there's potentials that look like they're being preordained that have to do with when you were born and where you were born and who your parents are. So how that happens, that is a limiting set of factors, Whitley. When you're born, where you're born, who your parents are, those are major limiting factors in what the possibilities are that you have. And the decisions they make are part of it. Astrology tries to pay some attention to all that. So there's already something that has to do with the seed of our future. But so much of this is what Anne has illustrated so clearly about you, is that she helped transform you from a frightened guy into a curious young man who has made a wonderful mission out of helping people understand realities that most of us have not experienced. That's choices each of you made when the choices were offered to you. So there is this free will thing. And I like to say, we all have free will. We don't have any choice.
That's a very interesting statement. Can you expand on that?
How can you have free will but no choice? You don't have any choice but to have free will.
Oh, I see.
You have no choice but... Yeah.
You don't have a choice, but you have the ability to disturb the matrix or what?
Yeah, you have choices to disturb, but you can choose not to. And that's the point I'm trying to say in response to the fate idea that you're bringing up. It's not so much, is it all determined? Unless you want to say all my choices are determined, and you can say that. But when I choose, there's something I feel like I am choosing. The I that is me is choosing. So that's where fate is not, it's too simple.
Free Dreamlanders, I forgot to put in this break. It's edited in. I would like to thank you for being with us. And thank you, as always, for joining the show. And I urge you to subscribe to the site. And also, on unknowncountry.com now, you can get The Fourth Mind, Them, Communion, The Hidden Garden, and some other books signed by me, beautiful hardcover copies. So visit unknowncountry.com and click on the store tab on the masthead, and you can get right to Whitley's books in the store.
Thank you for listening. Dreamland is brought to you by Unknown Country and its family of subscribers. Our news editor is Matthew Frizzell. Our site coordinator is Amy Safrankova. The founder of UnknownCountry.com is Anne Strieber. I'm Whitley Strieber, your host for Dreamland.